Welcome to Cloudlandia.
Mr. Sullivan.
It's a joy.
Wow. Here we are.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that we didn't really connect with Caroline before we went, and it was sitting in my schedule there, so yeah. You know.
So here we are.
If it was possible, I want it to be possible. But yeah, also, Phoenix doesn't change time. So, you know, we were 3 hours phone time away last night, but we're only 2 hours today. So I just wanted.
You're getting closer.
Yeah. It's like I had a client from Newfoundland once, and we were talking at the time of Quebec separation when Quebec was voting possibly to separate Canada. And I asked him, how do you feel about that? And he says, I'm for it. He says, I'm totally for Quebec separation. And I says, why? He says, because then St. John's will be that much closer to Toronto.
Exactly. 9:30 in Newfoundland.
No, but the whole province of Quebec would be missing.
Yes, exactly. So, get out of the way. We'll just shift everything to the west.
Yeah.
You know, I am an official.
We'd probably have to explain that to our listeners.
I am, by the way, an official Newfie. So I get to.
You were born in Gander. You were
born in Stephenville. Near Gander, yes. And so there's a, for our friends that are listening from other parts than Canada, Newfoundlanders have a very beloved place in the hearts and minds of Canadians, as often the, let's call it the blondes of the blonde joke world is the Newfie jokes in Canada. And that's one of the fun ones. If Quebec separates, that'll be in Newfoundland that much closer to Ontario.
Yeah.
Yes.
So anyway, we finished with Genius Friday night, and then there was a party on the Friday night. But we're just hanging around in Scottsdale for 2 or 3 days before we go down to Tucson. So
okay, nice. So you're here this week. Good.
Yeah. Yeah.
So where are you staying this time?
Royal Palms. Because we were going to spend time with Joe, you know, we were here, and we haven't, in person, we haven't seen him since the shutdown back in 2020. And then he gets last weekend, and it was a bummer for him. So anyway, the 2 days were really terrific.
Want to debrief a little on that?
Yeah.
Because that was you were experiencing it live, front and center.
Mm-hmm. It was, I think, our best in-person experience going back to 2011. That was when Babs and I first joined Genius Network. And it was
in New York.
First of all, you know, Joe's team, you know, they've really upped the game.
I have to say Tim Paulson did an amazing job of facilitating and orchestrating the event. He's really great in that role, and he did an amazing job.
I told him he'd been hiding. I said, "You've been hiding for 20 years."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We brought it out now, just in time to retire.
Yeah. Anyway, we thoroughly enjoyed it. It was, and he did a wonderful job conceptually structuring, you know, how to approach the 2 days. You know, he had those four sort of mindsets up front, follow the master. And so it was really nice because structuring content, you know, where people say, we're going to cover this, we're going to cover this, and cover this, doesn't interest me that much. But when you give up front a set of concepts, and I actually got a cue from that, you know, for my own ongoing workshops at the beginning, don't talk about the content of what's going to be happening, but these are the concepts, conceptual frameworks to keep in mind as we're going through next period of time. So that was a total pickup for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so what was
you can continually remind them of the concepts, you know, mm-hmm. I'm not saying contextual rather than conceptual, yeah. but the contextual, you know, you have to keep this in mind, like, halfway through feels like a failure, you know, and saying, so are you having experience? Are you really kind of, you know, challenged by this or, you know, kind of struggling with this? Remember, halfway through is feels like a failure. And mm-hmm. I said, gee, you know, that's really a terrific way of putting together a 2 day that has a lot of content. So it mm-hmm. gives people, kind of a overview. So anytime they're worried about if they're getting it or not getting, they you can just remind them, remember, we're halfway through. Mm-hmm. Babs just kissed, it's blew a kiss to you, and she's on her way out to the Henry.
Okay. Oh, my goodness. I love the Henry.
Yes.
I miss it. Yeah. Well, Dan, you know, what's funny, because last week we kind of talked a little bit about that halfway. You know, and it's even more deceptive digitally because we talked about, you know, the doublings of things, and mm-hmm. up until the last iteration, you're only halfway. Like doubling, that was what happened with the digital camera, right? Is it feels mm-hmm. like a failure, like this isn't going to be anything. That's why it's deceptive, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's at 0.2 pixels, megapixels, then 0.4, then 0.8, then 1.6. And then pretty soon, two more iterations, and you're at the highest level of any camera even available. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's totally the disruptive at that point, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting. Yeah. I think when we see these things now, you know, when you start talking about, like, I think when the domino, the big, like, colossal domino has been tipped now in terms of setting the metaverse into action. That there's no steering away from that now. That's an inevitability, right? And I think that we're getting that way with cryptocurrencies and that decentralized finance. I think these things, we're definitely at a cusp of at least the convergence of those two things shaping what's going to happen in the next, 5 years, kind of.
Yeah, I think the thing that the way I approach it from these predictions, first of all, they are predictions.
Yeah.
You know, and I was reading Gordon Moore. I was reading a little article on Gordon Moore, whose name is associated with the exponential, you know, the exponential progression of the microchip, basically.
Yeah.
And he was talking about a single device in the 1965. I think he wrote an article in a technical magazine, and he had three data points of seeing the processing power of what was called an integrated circuit. At that time, they hadn't put the name microchip on it yet. And mm-hmm. and he was talking that there might be an interesting progression here just based on three data points that maybe and perhaps every 18 months to 2 years, we might get doubling of the processing power. And mm-hmm. it seems to me that it costs less to do this. So you, mm-hmm. And it caught on immediately, like it became a wildfire. Yeah. And he was asked about that. He says, you know, you've almost like discovered a law here. And he says, actually, it's not. He says, it's not a law. He says, it's not like the law of gravity. But he says, what it is, it gives imaginative people a framework to actually aspire to a much bigger result. And, you know, and it seems to give a language that people can compare their progress against this particular mm-hmm. standard. And, you know, we can put a date on the calendar and say, okay, this is the beginning of the two-year doubling. And then everybody strives to actually achieve that. And my sense, the metaverse, I've been reading a lot about, you know, I've been reading articles about it. And when people say it's going to transform things, it means to, like, you know, at a certain point, everybody's going to be doing this. But half the planet right now doesn't have access to electricity. I mean, you know, electricity that could possibly power this type of technology. And it wouldn't be at the top of their list of things they want to achieve that day. But what it does say is that some individuals who have a lot of everything's handled in terms of, you know, their organization and their, you know, communication and their economics and everything else will create a way of operating more in this new world than they're operating in previous world. And that's what it means. And in fact, if you drop back now and said, well, is there any people right now, even before this becomes popular, are there any people right now who have actually been doing this for a long time? And the truth is that the Navy SEALs have been operating, and other special forces units in the military have been operating in the metaverse for quite a long time. In other words, they create complete three-dimensional digital
replicas or worlds,
replicas or setups of what the place looks like, or the destination place, and what the building looks like, and how do you approach it. And they practice in virtual realm, thousands, maybe halfway around the world, they practice, and then they work out angles, and then they say, well, what happened to you there? Are there any blind spots you have to worry about? So my sense is that that there's two places generally where technology makes its greatest advances with a small number of people before it becomes available to a large number of people. And one of them is weaponry or war.
Right.
And the other one is games. And so my feeling in the games world, this has been operating for quite a long time, and in the military world, it's been operating for a long time.
In the intelligence world, I wonder, like you wonder about DARPA and what that kind of, I mean, crazy stuff we don't even know about.
I mean, in its simplest form, like, you know, airline, you know, pilot training now is done all in simulators, you know.
And have been for years,
Oh, yeah. I mean, 30 years ago, there's a place near Pearson Airport in Toronto. It's called EAS. And they're the number one provider of cockpit simulators for airline pilots. And the pilots have to go in there, and they have to test on a regular basis. So my sense is that, you know, when predictions are made about technology, you have to understand these technologies are already being used by some people. And what the projection is, like, you know, with Mark Zuckerberg a couple of weeks ago and other people talking about that, they want the experience to be mass consumed, like everybody is doing this. And to a certain extent, they're trying to sell people, well, you got to get into this as soon as possible. And so I think it's not so much a technological projection, it's a marketing message.
And that's, I think, you know, when you look at the, we mentioned, I've been watching these history of things, and I think that we're looking now that, you know, 100 years from now, or 150 years from now, we'll look back at the men who built the metaverse as the same, in the same way we look at the guys that, you know, wired the country for electricity, and the guys that wired laid the the roadways and the railroads, all of that as foundational infrastructure. And that's the platform. Then I think that I'm starting to look for Like, what are the second and third waves of it? Like, once the railroad was there, that then laid the platform for what other types of opportunities on top of that. Yeah. That's where I think that's where I get excited. That's where I kind of tend to look, is to adapt the things that are, you know, available there in new ways that we can use that infrastructure.
Well, I've been, you know, doing a project for a couple of years, self-driving automobiles, okay, and, you know, because the predictions have not come true of how fast.
Not in the way that,
self-driving automobiles. And I started, you know, I was noticing that there was growing anger in the part of the proponents of, you know, why public officials and, you know, weren't catching on. They weren't getting with, you know, they weren't getting with the program, you know, and everything else. And so what I created was a file of all the reasons why self-driving cars won't happen. And so there's lots of articles and there's lots of little checklists, 7 reasons why self-driving cars won't happen. And it was an interesting example because they can't figure out where the key sensors are going to be. The key sensor is going to be in the car, or the key sensor is going to be in the environment. Like, for example, that the cars will have a uniform kind of system which picks up on cues from outside the car.
Yeah.
So that what that guarantees is that all the cars are picking up on the same environmental cues.
Yeah.
You know, from outside.
Uh-huh.
You know, and that's not, they're nowhere of knowing whether that's true, because the reason is that if you're going to have a major breakthrough, it probably has to be the environment that is uniform, not the independent. It'd be when trains first started, they didn't realize that you had to have a common gauge. In other words, that the tracks had to be uniformly apart. And then you make all the different manufacturers who make locomotives and cars, they have to build their cars so that it meets the grade. So everybody's wheels. And self-driving cars aren't anywhere near that standardization yet. They aren't, you know, because they're in competition with each other. Well, first of all, they're at the stage where it's just that they're striving to be electric cars, and the whole notion that then this is a platform then where it would be self-driving cars. So they're a long way away because it interacts with municipal laws. It interacts with, you know, the political system. And I was so somebody took an example of New York City and Manhattan, and they said, you know, well, let's just talk about a mile of street in Manhattan where we put all the sensors in. And they estimated, you know, to put in the sensors, it'd probably be about $1.5 million, $2 million a mile.
Oh, wow.
And that's not, which automatically becomes $3 million a mile because of bribery and payoffs and work stoppages and strikes.
Yeah.
And, so a $3 million mile, but you can't do just 1 mile. You got to do the entire system because just having that self-driving for 1 mile really wouldn't do it. And so the obstacles, the number of meetings to talk about obstacles goes up exponentially.
Right.
And then do people want that or do not people want to do that? So I was talking to Peter one day, and I said, you know, when you have these predictions, all the money is actually in the obstacles.
Mm-hmm. Solving the obstacles, of course.
Yeah, that's where all the money is.
Yeah,
that's where all the money is. I said, the money isn't in the payoff. The money is in everything that prevents the payoff.
Transforming obstacles.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and you can see this in our world, you know, of just to use an example, the tax code. I mean, if there's anything that's gotten exponential in our common experience, it's the tax code.
You know,
I mean, our tax code, my personal tax code, you know, at one point might have been 5 pages and now it's 500 pages. I mean, you know, there's been exponential growth in the tax code. And then all the money is in consulting and, you know, accountants and lawyers and everything to deal with the complexity of the tax code. Yeah,
this is wild. I mean, you wonder. I mean, that's kind of the talk of how the NFTs could change that level of thing too, if it were embraced. That could be that just inherent within it is the almost like a circulation tax in a way of currency or whatever money gets exchanged and used for, that there's that siphoning, transactional siphoning, almost like a transfer tax. There, that's a possibility, you know? It's really, I think, yeah, things are going to heat up here in this next little while. I mean, you must
can I bring up another point that was brought up in our last podcast? And you made a statement that you find me the most analog person that you probably know. And I was thinking about that during the week. And could you put a couple, you know, other observations with that? So that, first of all, that I can understand what you're seeing, but our listeners can understand that I'm sort of analog.
Yeah. So you have an iPhone, but the number one person dialed on that is this number that we're talking on right now. That every 95% of the minutes that you have available are spent in one thing. You're not accessible digitally in a way that most people are accessible. And people who know you and are close to you are around that. I mean, you understand that. I imagine that there are a handful of people, maybe a bigger handful of people who actually have your email address.
Yeah.
So I know I can email you if I need to reach you or want to, but I wouldn't dream of texting you or calling you. They don't have that. And by analog, I think I mean it in the best way of asynchronous at your discretion is how you engage.
Mm-hmm.
Not synchronously and interruptively. You know, most people who are, once you're plugged in to the digital way, is that we're interruptive, that we're tapped in. Like, you know, it's interesting, just this exchange right now. Here we are, you sent an email to me this morning after we had talked last week. I thought that you were going to be at Canyon Ranch this week and that we were, it was an off week. And then I got your email because I have my digital, you know, tethering device in my hands, and I saw that and I was able to email you back and we jump on and did this. So that I don't have that level of confidence that you're reactively checking your email at all times or whatever. I don't feel like that, and that's what I mean by that is analog in that way. You are disconnected from TV and from interruptive piped in programming that is sent your way. And you are selectively curating, seeking what you want to bring into your attention. You know, you're that's, I mean, there's part of it, but I mean, just almost in every way where people are more digitally tapped in, you are standing apart. You know, you're not connecting to in a digital way. You're using Facebook. You're using these things on your team. Mm-hmm. Things are happening, but you're not getting any of it on you. You know, you're very insulated from that. So I feel that's my take on it, that you're directing it and, you know, contributing your, you know, thoughts or content.
Yeah, and the reason I'm bringing this up, because we had Ned Halliwell giving a talk on, you know, on ADHD. And when I had gotten my analysis, it was with the Amen Clinic. Joe Polish and Babs and I went to Newport Beach, and this is 2010, 2011. And I'd heard about, you know, that the testing, you know, I'd seen a little article I saw, you know, on the internet about this testing, and it was 3 days of testing. And long story short, we went and, you know, we did it. And but before you were admitted to their program, you had to go online, and they had a 200-point questionnaire, 200 mm-hmm. questions that you had to, which I was thinking would probably screen out about 95% of ADD.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. But in my case, I don't have a problem with that kind of thing. I like being asked questions and then, you know, coming up. And it was like a 360 degree analysis of your personal life, your professional life, and how you organize yourself, and you know, what your family situation was growing up, and what you observed about your parents and your, you know, your siblings, because ADD is very inheritable. It's of all psychological characteristics, I think it's you know, near the top of things which will be inherited from parents to children. And it's very clear to me that both my parents, I mean, looking back and knowing what I know about ADHD, it's very clear to me that they both were, had this. And but it's very clear to me that none of my siblings do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're very focused. You know, they're very orderly, very, very structured.
Mm-hmm.
And except for one brother who actually committed suicide. And it made me think that this condition, not understood back in the 1950s, not understood in the 1960s, got him into difficult situations, which compounded kind of his sense. And at a certain point, he, you know, it got it mixed up with drugs and all sorts of other things, and he committed suicide. But anyway, so I did that, and so I answered all the questions, then went to the clinic in Newport Beach and did it's about 3 hours a day, 3 days of testing with brain scan machines, and then they measure you at rest, measure you in activity, concentration, memory, alertness, response time, everything. And then they put together a report, and then there's a two-hour wrap-up talk with one of their specialists, who's a psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. And she said, you know, she's, I was really looking forward to talking to you, she says, because in all my experience of doing these tests with people, you have the widest difference between what the answers to your questionnaire tell us and what the test tells. She said, your answers to the questionnaire prompted my question, why is he even coming and talking to us? He, you know, there's no need for him, you know, to have anything done, because he lives in a very orderly environment. It's very structured. You know, seems to not be overwhelmed by all sorts of interruptions and distractions. He seems to have a good control of time. And, you know, he doesn't have a lot of complications in his life. But she said, the test, you've got like a 10-ring circus going on all the time.
Right.
And she says, can you explain that? So I said, well, it all comes down to who owns the circus.
You're in control of the circus, right?
I'm in control of the circus, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and I think I said, the way your test described me is my daily experience. I'm constantly being thrown off track.
Yeah.
So what I've done is that I've systematically, and I think probably if I can measure back when I started creating thinking tools for myself, it was probably late teens that I was starting to create tools where I could think through certain situations and then come up with a really good solution for me and then work to make that solution a daily habit.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah. And she said, well, and then we got into the strategic coach. And she said, well, she says, this really explains a lot, because she said, I don't know who else you created this strategic coach program for, but I do know that you created it for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, what's funny is that's the what I mentioned when Ned was talking. I think it was in response to a question from Babs talking about the 50-minute focus finder. That mm-hmm. was something that I created for myself, just on mm-hmm. observation. Like, I'll tell it quickly so for people who haven't heard me talk about it, but you know, I was observing that it was difficult for me to do the things that I knew I wanted to do, like to get myself to sit down and focus. And I started, one of the great questions that I always ask myself, is that true? Are there situations where I do focus, right? And I started thinking, I don't have any problem at all focusing for 4.5 hours on playing a round of golf. I find it delightful. I do it regularly and successfully, and I don't have any problems with that. I love going to movies. I can focus for up to 3 hours watching a movie. You know, I'm very focused and disciplined in that. It can't distract me from it or take me off course. And I started thinking, okay, so what is it about golf that allows me to demonstrate that level of focus? What is it about the environment of it that is allowing me to do it? Because at the time, I was playing 2 or 3 rounds of golf a week. And I recognized that my system for that was that I knew the times that I was going to play golf. I had a goal. So I made the acronym of golf, G-O-L-F. And G was, I had a goal. I was going to play mm-hmm. golf. I've defined my outcome, what I was going to do. I'm going to play golf. And I would put it on my calendar, and I knew who I was going to play with, where I was going to play, what time I was going to play. And it was there, and my whole week would work around it. And I would arrange so that I would show up on time, just like our Big Four, show up on time and do what I say I'm going to do and finish what I start and say please and thank you. But the, you know, when I would show up, and then the O is for an optimal environment, and a mm-hmm. golf course is the optimal environment for playing golf. It's mm-hmm. laid out exactly like we need it to be, 18 sequential holes with a little path to keep you on track, broken down with benchmarks along the way. You keep your score yeah. as you're going all the way to stay on track. You know your progress. Then L is for limited distractions, right? Mm-hmm. When you're on the golf course, if you leave your phone in your locker and you are out there off the grid, there's very little distraction to to take you off task. And F is for a fixed time frame. That we know, I know it's going to take 4.5 hours or 4 hours to play golf. And same thing with a movie. If I'm going to a movie, I know that it's 2 hours or 3 hours at the, if it's an epic movie. But I never have a problem blocking those things off. So I started taking my cues from that and applying that framework to the things that I wanted to do. And so I would define what it is that I want to do in terms of the goal. What do I want to do? I want to, and I'd have a verb for whatever it is. We talked about the verbs on the Joy of Procrastination podcast. Often it would be brainstorm and outline or record, or those are my the power verbs, or think about whatever these are. So I'd say, I want to think about this project or this book or this program that I'm working on, and I'll block it in the thing. And then the optimal environment, where's the optimal environment for this? What is my power position for this? For me, most of the time, my number one power position is sitting on my white couch in my courtyard with my journal and or my Remarkable and thinking, right? I'm in the position there. But what I have to also do is limit distractions. So that means that I leave my phone in another room. There's no internet. There's no anything there. I'm in a quiet environment. There's no people to distract me, no TV, no computer, none of that. I'm just limited distraction, focused in my environment for a fixed time frame. I have an egg timer. I have an egg timer, non-digital, analog, that twists to 50 minutes. And I sit and I can focus for those 50 minutes. And that is how I work around, you know, my created that as a workaround. And it's the most, it's like the base unit of productivity for me. Everything, no matter what I'm going to do, requires me to be able to focus for at least, you know, that 50 minutes at a time, be multiples of that. But that's the base unit. It's just repeating that same process. And so that technology for me is my, that's my workaround.
So just a couple observations is that I totally understand, you know, I totally understand exactly what you've pulled off, you know, in the past to get to where you are and how you're going to pull it off in the future. And because it checks out all the boxes of exactly why I've done what I've done. And then the other thing about it is I would never do it the way that you do it, and you would never do it the way that I do it.
Yeah, tell me your model.
No, but and what I mean by that is that the individual strategies and the individual structures that you've created are uniquely yours. And, you know, and part of it is because you've tested them and this works, and there's nine that didn't work, and there's this whole, you know, there's this whole looking backwards, there's this whole path from the backwards horizon of things you've tried that worked and didn't work and didn't work, and you've gradually refined them down to the things that always work. You know, they just always
It was interesting to me that they're the things that, like, you know, pulling off playing golf for 4.5 hours three times a week is, that's a pretty disciplined focus. And going to movies, you know, being, you know, setting up that time every Friday afternoon, we'd go to the movies and record a movie review. You know, those things are disciplined, you know, repeatable things that I was already, there's clues in my life that I am capable of taking repetitive, focused action, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So identifying it.
So what I'm saying, I'm applying this back to the metaverse world.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm saying that I think that there's a boundary in the future between two uniquely different kinds of people. Mm-hmm. And that is, there are people who can only feel structure for themselves, you know, in a kind of a sense of, you know, pleasure, actually, you know, they have, I'll call it pleasurable structure, that they have structure only by consuming what other people have created. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a whole consumption side of this.
Yes.
And then on the other side of the line are people who create their own pleasurable structures because yes. the stuff that other people create are subpar.
You know, right.
And that's the entrepreneurial crossover, you know, because the vast yeah. majority of people, I mean, for all the talk about, you know, how entrepreneurism is increasing, there's actually no statistical evidence that it's changed in the last 50 years. You know, it's about 5% of the working population, the adult population, actually brings their useful income, you know, their necessary and useful income by their own means. So, you know, they have to initiate something and create something. And everybody else has to have it created for them. They have to, you know, they have to have an employer or a corporation.
I've been thinking, I've been trying to plant this seed for Philip here about the concept of makers and takers.
Yeah.
You know, and that's really a big distinction.
Yeah, and that's exactly, you know, I mean, using two different words than I use, but that's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah.
That it has to be given to you. It has to be given to you. Someone else has to give it to you. And what I did is, you know, I had created, and I think, you know, it's nudging ahead to the front of the line for one of my quarterly books. And it's the book that I call Thinking About Your Thinking. Mm-hmm. And what I said is the vast majority of thinking that goes around you, you know, in daily life on the planet falls into three areas that people are thinking about things. You know, there's things around us, things we like, things we don't like, things other people have, things we have, and things we're acquiring, things we want to acquire, things are no longer useful. But it's about things, and these are objects. And without any question, they were things that were actually created by other people. You know, they were.
Yeah.
So we are born into a world where, you know, a world of many things. The other one is they think about people. Okay, they think about other people. And there's constantly a nonstop self-comparing themselves with other people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And one of the things they self-compare themselves with other people is what kind of things that other people have that are better than their things.
Isn't that amazing? It's so true. The Kardashians, the Real Housewives, all of these things that as a society people are wired to do this.
Yeah. And then the third level up, people who think about thoughts, but they're not their thoughts. They collect, you know, thoughts, you know, and the thoughts of other people.
They follow pundits, right?
Yeah. And they compete with other people. They to have thoughts that are superior to the thoughts that other people have. Okay. In other words, and so there's a competition with others, competition on the level of things, competition on the level of people and who you get to hang out with, and competition on the level of thoughts.
Yes.
You know, I have acquired relationships with people who, because they have these thoughts, they're able to acquire these things, and everything that I have is better than people that I want to feel superior to. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But not once in this entire process, and this can go from birth to life, have you ever actually thought about how you're thinking about things?
Right. Yeah.
And then you cross over to a line and you say, well, I know all that exists. That's not really where I get my pleasure. I get my pleasure actually out of creating my own ways of looking at what's happening to me and then stepping back and having kind of an interesting exploration and, you know, exploration and of just how is it that I'm thinking about things.
Right. That's the great joy. That's what I love. Look, that's what journaling has done.
Oh yeah,
for me, that's been my
that was my breakthrough. Journal for 25 years straight. You know,
yeah.
Every day. Well, I want this. I want this. I want this. And it wasn't. And I couldn't use the word because referred back to other people's worlds.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah,
the word because always means that you're comparing to other people, or you're justifying yourself to other people. I said, well, I'm not doing this to justify. I just want to get a handle on what I want, you know, and everything like that. So my sense is that one of the reasons why we enjoy talking to each other so much is that we both have gone across that line into thinking about our thinking.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And other people are doing that. It's kind of like an endless world where when you find someone else who does thinking about their thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And generally speaking, they've kind of handled the whole world of things, people, and thoughts.
Yeah, that's, it's funny. The thinking is, I look at it as at the highest level of the most valuable things that I've done have come from thinking about my thinking like that, something like I look at one of the highest and I create time for it. You know, mm-hmm. This is the thing. It's the most valuable thing I can do is sit, you know, in my comfy chair right here thinking about, and I have an unending appetite for it.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, it's effortless to me and increasingly enjoyable. Yeah.
So I'd like to take this back to the analog, you know, your observation mm-hmm. about analog land is that when I'm thinking about my thinking, I don't like being interrupted by the world of things, people, and thoughts.
That's what it is. That's, you've created that optimal environment. I call that removing the reactive activators, because mm-hmm. The thing that takes you off that track is not, you know, more often than not, it's a reactive activator that mm-hmm. somebody calls you on that phone or somebody texts you on that phone or you get some kind of notification. And that then takes you into that environment, which takes you onto the internet, which takes you to the cat videos, next thing you know. And it's all because you reacted to that activator. If you don't have it there, that's the great thing about, you know, the great thing about the analog world was that the newspaper came once a day.
Mm-hmm.
The, you know, it wasn't, the magazines were printed once a month. The mail came once a day. There were, the inputs were at a frequency that was, you know, manageable. It wasn't disruptive. And I think,
because the time in between issues, you know, like issues, that generally speaking, the content probably had at least a 1 day or 2 day value, you know.
Yeah.
So if you didn't get it, so if I missed the morning's paper and I didn't get to this morning's paper until tomorrow morning, I could still read it. And what was written was sufficiently still useful. It was still useful. But
it wasn't immediately refuted. by the opposition to that idea in equally disruptive and convincing ways.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really the thing, right? It's the number of voices and the commitment of the polls, the polarity of the opposition and in favor to 100% discredit any information. I mean, you get one thing's printed about, hey, good news for vaccines. Then 3 seconds later, vaccines are killing you. It's the mind control. It's the stupidest thing. That this battle by the most diligent, thoughtful army of people 100% dedicated to furthering your hatred for or belief in vaccines. In a convincing way. I mean, everybody's megaphone is 100% professional appearing. It's very difficult to make sense of, even with an earnest, effort to do so. It's very difficult to make sense. I mean, you and I both have friends that are doctors at the highest levels, and often they don't even agree on things. So what chance do you really have for doing the right thing?
It's a really good question, because we were, after the party on Friday night, we were over to dinner, the owner of the sanctuary resort here, Bob Castellinas, I think his name is.
Yeah.
So, and he was in. I hadn't met him before. Joe had talked a lot about him, but he was
Bob Castellini, right?
Castellini, And so we were, he's got this mountaintop. He's got, I think, the highest mountaintop home in Paradise Valley, And so we were up there and we were talking, and Nick Sonnenberg was there, and we got into discussion about politics and the current situation and everything else, and Nick says, I don't know in that world how you know anything. He says, how do you know anything in the political world? And it was an interesting discussion, because my experience with Nick is that anytime you bring up, there's kind of like a waving off on Nick's part, that's not even an area of discussion where you can actually know anything. It's all emotions and so things. And I said, I've met people in your world, in the technology world, where they talk in theories and they talk in projections and everything else. And I said, how do you know in choosing technology whether anything's real? He says, well, there's fundamental principles. And I said, I got that. And here's what I get about it, that in your world, there are fundamental principles that I don't know. And therefore, a lot of your world looks like gibberish to me. But I want you to know that in the political world, there's fundamental principles that you don't know. So all of it from the outside looks like gibberish to you. And I say that's true in a million different worlds, that there's somebody who's really really been fascinated and gone deep in a particular world, and they're at the level of fundamental principles, and 100 years ago, we shared more, a less deep understanding of the world, but what we shared more in common were a lot of fundamental principles that allowed us to operate with each other. And I think what's happened 100 years later is that each of us have been able to go deep into something where our experience is that we're actually operating in our thinking and our decision-making, our communication and action from the standpoint of fundamental principles. And the person we're talking to doesn't get this. And so we form an opinion about them, they don't know anything. They don't know anything. Well, they don't know anything about our deep world, we don't know anything about their deep world either.
Right. Yeah. That's well said. I mean, that's something that's true. When you don't know, it's like, your mind, your eyes only see your ears only hear
yeah
what you're looking for, right?
So I think the were you there on Thursday? I know you were there for Ned's on Friday, but were you there for Thursday?
I remember
Craig Shoemaker, you know, and his laughter thing.
Yeah.
I think that this is why laughter is so important, is because people with radically different deep worlds can still find things funny.
Yes. I agree. And that's funny. The differences are often funny. Shining a light and isolating the polarity is very funny. And the fact that the polarity exists is funny.
It's funny. Yeah.
And people's commitment to it is funny.
Yeah. Yeah. I had the, you know, the man, Casey Fleming, who was the China, you know, giving the warning about China.
Yes. Yeah.
He was at my table, you know, and I talked to him, and I, you know, I kind of got, I fell into, you know, I immediately reverted to, I'm a 6-year-old and I'm talking to a 45-year-old. So I don't know anything, but I, you know, what's happening in the adult world? And I just asked him questions like this. So he told me, you know, and I kept asking him questions about, you know, why he got on this track and everything else. And the more I asked him about why he got on this track, the less tense he was. I mean, he was kind of, you know, he was a little bit tense in the meeting. And so we were talking, and after the, we had seen him, and that was, you know, that whole talk really put people, you know, I mean, people started sitting up, their eyes started getting really big and everything like that. And then Craig Shoemaker, they did a good timing because they had Craig Shoemaker come on, and he just had everybody laughing for about an hour or so. And I said, you know, I think the ideal next version of what we just saw over the last 2 hours was next time Casey has to conduct an hour of laughing and Craig has to conduct an hour of talking about China.
Now that would be funny. You're right. Oh boy.
And I said, because actually both areas of knowledge are really important, but each of them can only go so far and taking us deep with his knowledge. And I said, probably switching roles for an hour would probably give each of them an expanded sense of where they could go next with their own interest, you know?
Yes, very funny.
Maybe the solution to the whole China thing is just to start creating China jokes.
Laugh at them, right.
Yeah, okay, and just send them China jokes, you know? And that, you know. And then they're little spies, you know. I said, you know, if they're collecting all the information, like, you know, there's 330 million Americans, and how much complexity is there every day that we're doing digitally? And they're collecting that, and that's just part of the world. They got their own 1.4 million people that they got to keep a handle on. How many people in the Chinese Communist Party is this using up every day just to collect the information, you know?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, they must have 6-7 million people. And how do you decide at the end of each day what are the 1 or 2, 3 things that we've heard out of a quadrillion pieces of information that are important for tomorrow? You know, it seems to me that they're, you know, they're. And Ronald Reagan, who had Soviet jokes, you know, and it was very tense during the 1980s, but he had all these Soviet jokes. And he would tell them in every public. And it just drove the Russians crazy.
Right.
Because don't they realize that the Marxist-Leninist communist view of the world is the most profound and serious insight ever?
Oh,
and,
man.
You know, and you everything. But he just laughed at it. Yeah, and he laughed at it. But the other thing he said, you know, he said, we're so worried about the Soviets having our secrets. And he said, I got a way of solving this. He said, I got a way of solving this problem with the Soviets. He said, every month we have 1,000 747s and we just load them up with a month's worth of American secrets, you know, the last month's secrets. And we fly and we dump them on the runway, all the secrets. We just dump it all on the runways
right.
in Moscow. And he says, just having them try to sort that out would bring their entire empire to a collapse. And I think, you know, in a certain way, that's actually what happened.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you can't keep it down. You can't keep it. We got more secrets, making more every day.
You think you've got our secrets? You haven't seen anything yet.
That's right, exactly.
Yeah, well, I think this is very rich territory, you know,
yes. If
you combine last week's and this week. I think
yeah.
It's very rich, because my feeling is the maker-taker line that you were talking to Philip about is the crucial is your life going to be a taking life, or is your life going to be a making life?
Yeah,
you know?
And the fact is, Dan, it's getting easier and easier to be a taker, too. It's very... That division is, it's very tempting to live a very comfortable taker life.
Right? Yeah. I mean, it's very interesting, but what has changed is that I was talking to someone, you know, about what I think the stakes are right now in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that the stakes are a definition of what humans are in relationship to computers, okay?
Mm.
And the singularity model, I'll just use that. And I'm not talking strictly, you know, about Singularity University. But the singularity is an idea that's been around for 70, 80 years. You know, it didn't start with, what's his name? Peter's partner who created the singularity together.
Oh, Kurzweil.
Yeah, Ray Kurzweil. I mean, yeah. He was just picking up on something that had already been discussed by, you know, uh-huh. dozens of other people, you know. But the basic premise there is that the human being is an information processing, the human brain is an information processing mechanism, and that computers are information processing mechanisms,
uh-huh.
and that we're not getting any faster, but the computers are getting faster, and there's a point in the future, you know, 10 years, 20 years, where there's a crossover, and that the human the computers are better information processing units, and then it goes exponentially from there, and therefore the stage when humans were the information processing, you know, ultimate, that's, and we become obsolete. I said, well, yeah. You know, if your premise is true, you know, that we're information processing. And I said, but what if human brain isn't information processing? As a matter of fact, it has nothing to do with information. And what we are is meaning making.
Mm-hmm.
The brain is a meaning making that
yeah.
we have inputs, but the inputs are actually kind of irrelevant, because we just take the inputs and do something totally different with them, because we get real pleasure out of creating new types of meaning. And we like playing with the meaning that we make, and we like trading the meaning that we make. And then
yeah.
if two of us get together, we can make different kinds
share
of
meaning. Share the meaning.
And, uh-huh. and the information, I mean, the information is just, you know, it's... We don't need much of it. We can do a lot with not very much, you know, and everything like that. So if you have 100 computers and you give it the information, you know, the information coming in, they more or less have to do the same thing, because they're computers. That's what
yeah.
a computer is, you know.
Yep.
In other words, we like computers because they're predictable. We like humans because they're not.
Unpredictable. Predictably
yeah.
irrational.
I mean, a predictable human being is a long day. Yeah, I mean, 5 hours with a predictable human being is a week.
Oh, that's so funny.
Okay, you know, and, you know, 5 minutes with an unpredictable computer is really scary.
Right, that's exactly right. Frustrating.
So my feeling is that we're getting to the point where one of those things is true. You know, the first one, that humans were just inferior early models of transcendent computers, or we're something completely different. And computers are just some of the meaning that we've kind of created and tested out for a while. And it's okay, you know, but there's always, you know, there's always something better we can do with them. And the big question is, you know, because if, you know, if it's the first that computers are, then we're doomed to be total takers until the computers no longer have any use for us.
They don't need us. No,
they don't
more
need us anymore.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that's what I'm seeing, you know, as I put the two things together, and both of them are, you know, both of them are guesses, you know.
Yes.
And at a certain point, you know, humans are always guessing, and we're always betting on certain guesses rather than others. And I just see what's happening here. But our conversation and the line that you crossed over and the line I crossed over, where the real pleasure is structuring our environment in such a way that we can spend increasing amount of time thinking about our thinking.
Yes, that's exactly right. And then in the words of whose line is it anyway, you realize that the points are, everything's made up and the points don't matter. Oh, it's so funny. It's true.
Okay, quick wrap up.
It's been delightful. This was great that we got to pull this off. I enjoyed that. I thought about, for another thought that's going to come out of this is thinking about our thinking, but also what we're representing to think about our thinking out in the through our avatars. You know, that's something. Mm-hmm. I just saw some courtroom footage about Hulk Hogan when the big Gawker lawsuit was happening, about he was suing them for publishing his sex tape, and was arguing the difference between the Hulk Hogan persona and Terry Bollea, the person, and that they have different rights and levels of expectation of privacy. And Todd Herman has his book Alter Ego, which is very mainstream right now. And there's actually a television called Alter Ego, where these avatars are presenting in a singing competition. And I think that there's some seed of some neat, you know, next level things that are happening here. So I'll circle back with that because I'll let that thought percolate, but it's just something that's in the crock pot right now, just kind of marinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, the interesting thing is when you're looking into the future and you're seeing the emergence of something,
yeah,
it's also useful to look back where that was always happening.
Mm-hmm.
And that where you are right now is maybe at the halfway point between something that started a long time ago.
Oh,
and,
that's interesting.
And you see what I'm saying? Is
yes.
We always think that we're at zero and we're seeing in the future.
Yeah.
But I said, and the other thing is that maybe it took 10,000 years of experimenting with other things to get to the halfway point. But the the second half can happen in, you know, in exponentially.
And that's maybe what alter ego has been.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
Alter ego, the Clark Kent Superman, the Batman Bruce Wayne, all of those things have been historically, you know, it's been a common thing. And now this digitally going forward, they can take on their own digital identities. And that's an interesting thing.
Well, they can interact with each other in, you know, in a way that's not predictable.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I think predictability gets boring fast.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm glad we used analog
connected.
Time to get.
Yes, exactly.
Digitally connected. Yes, thank you.
I love it. Okay, Dan.
Okay, bye.